Good morning to all of you. It's so good to have you in the class this morning as we're continuing our study of the book of Acts. There are those who approach the book of Acts and believe that a study of it is just redundant. We've already studied that. We know everything that there is to know about the book of Acts. And I'm convinced that's just not so. We think that it is such a common book and we study it so much that maybe we don't need to be studying it properly. But I'm finding that it is one of the most foundational studies that we can do in the New Testament. And the reason is, as we've said many times, it forms a skeleton upon which the epistles may be hung. And so the efforts of the apostles during first century times to make known the message of the gospel, to preach the gospel to every creature, we see that recorded in this one book of New Testament history. And so it's significant. We need to read it. We need to study it and be very familiar with it so that our efforts to teach those who are not Christians might be successful. We're studying this morning in the ninth chapter of the book of Acts as we're talking about the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. Now, we noted in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 12 and following, how that Paul describes to Timothy what he was in time past, how that he considered himself chief among sinners. We're going to be looking at other passages where Paul talks about how that he was least among the apostles, not meet to be called an apostle. And we'll note in Ephesians chapter 3, in verse 8, where he was charged to preach the unsearchable riches of Christ unto the Gentiles, and he calls himself the least of all saints. Was this grace given? What a remarkable thing to say about himself, which tells us that when we look at his history, the things that he did in the Jews' religion that to a prominent Jew at the time were very valuable and to his credit, but as a Christian, marked him with a big black X to indicate that he was to be the subject of persecution. He's a traitor to the cause of Judaism. And when we read of his conversion, we've noted that there are three chapters in the book of Acts that we want to think of together. What are they? Acts 9, 22, and 26. And so we're going to be looking at material from these three chapters. And hopefully we'll not reiterate everything that's said when we come to chapter 22 and then again to chapter 26. But to be familiar with the facts of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus and the things that we want to be impressed with in our efforts to try to teach those who are not Christians. In our study this morning, as we have not every time we meet, but occasionally, to try to identify the chapters, and Sarah, I'm going to begin with you. The establishment of the church. What chapter? Chapter 2. Chris, you're next. Paul's address to those in Antioch. Pisidia. Yes, I need to change that. Antioch of Pisidia. All right, chapter 13. Chapter 13. The persecution of the church by Saul. James? All right, first part of 8, we know that he made havoc of the church. The arrest of Peter by Agrippa the First and Peter's miraculous release. Randy?
12.
Yes, and I'm glad you thought of that readily because you think of the execution of James in that chapter by Herod. And, of course, also in that chapter, Herod eaten up of worms as he took the credit of being a god. Paul or Saul brought to Antioch by Barnabas. Carolyn? Anyone? All right, 11. Very good. Paul's vision at Troas. Lem? 16. Very good. Lem, Paul's speech on Mars Hill in Athens. I'll stand out of your way. 17, yes. Paul and Barnabas call gods at Lystra. Donna? No?
That's 14.
Yes, sir. That's 14. The Susane maiden cleansed in Philippi. Noah? Think Philippi. What chapter? 16. All right, good. The reception of the Holy Spirit gifts through the laying on of the hands of Peter and John. Tommy, you want to join us? Not yet. Okay. Chris? 8. All right. The disciples' sacrifices of benevolence. James?
4.
All right. Chapter 4. Yeah, right at the end of 4, you're thinking of Ananias and Sapphira, of what they did in chapter 5, motivated by what Barnabas did at the end of chapter 4. Back to you, Randy, the martyrdom of James.
I will give
12. 12. You're very good. I tell you. Conversion of Apollos at Ephesus. Jerry?
19.
All right. 18. I thought 19 as well, but that's 18. Paul's defense, including his own account of his conversion before the people of Jerusalem. James, that's to you, and the key is before the people.
Should be 22.
The healing of Aeneas by Peter. Jonathan.
I'll go with that.
You'll go with 9. All right. Beginning of the third evangelistic tour. Donna. All right. Paul before Felix. James, we're back to you. Process that.
25.
No. All right, 24. 24. Paul before the people in 22, before the Jewish court in 23, before Felix in 24, before Festus in 25, and before Agrippa in 26. All right, now that's a good way to remember that. The healing of the lame man by Peter and John, that's in chapter 3, folks. And we'll move right along here. We were talking about Saul in our last study, introducing this study of the conversion of Saul. And we were talking about his history and his character. We noted that he was born of a great race. The passage perhaps that we would look at among these two would probably be the one in the Philippian letter, in Philippians chapter 3, beginning in verse 3, verse 5 specifically. He says that he was circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee. What does that tell us about him as we look at these individual things? He was circumcised the eighth day. We know that the law required that, and certainly he had complied, that had been complied with. He was of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin. Denise, why is that so significant? Of the tribe of Benjamin. Why would that be a plus to anybody? Yes, but even back further. Yes, but back further. Benjamin was the favorite son. Joseph's real brother, fleshly brother on both sides. And so he is of the tribe of Benjamin. So he is of a great race. We note that he is a Pharisee. What does that tell us about him? Well, it tells us that he was of the elite of the Jews. Who were the Pharisees, Donna? Can you tell me something?
Spiritual rulers?
Well, yeah. Plows a little deeper than that. They were the elite class. The people that stood up so straight, they made laws where God had not made laws. And so the Pharisees were, as Bruce pointed out, yes, they were educated. And this passage indicates that Paul was educated, brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, one of the most famous of the Jewish teachers. But he was a Pharisee, the strictest sect of the Jews. And he was very religious. What does that tell us about him there in James? James, what does that tell us about him in Acts chapter 26, verses 4 and 5?
He would be very zealous and devout.
Zealous and devout, that's right. He took this serious. And we noted in the text of Galatians 1, how zealous was he, James?
Very.
Well, now that's well put.
He was zealous enough that he was willing to go and get permission from the Jewish government to drag people out of their homes and put them to death.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And he was very conscientious. And there are a number of passages that help us with that. Often when we talk about having a good conscience, we look at Acts 23, verse 1, where Paul presented before who? The Jewish Sanhedrin, the court. He said, I have lived before God in all good conscience unto this day. But I think the one that I would emphasize would be Acts 26, beginning in verse 9, where Paul said, I thought I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which also I did. And he elaborates in the remaining portion of that as to what he did. So being of good conscience doesn't satisfy everything. And as we talk further about Saul, we noted that he persecuted the church. James, you emphasized that from Galatians chapter 1, verse 13. Paul, in writing to Timothy about 20 years after his conversion, said the same thing, that he sought to make them blaspheme. And so that tells us the extent to which he went. In Acts chapter 8, and in verse 3, there the text tells us, but Saul laid waste the church, entering into every house and dragging men and women, committed them to prison. Now, I want us to see that we're not talking about a word that's thrown around quite a lot these days, ideology. Paul was an activist, if you please. He would go to folks' homes, and having some reason to believe that they were a Christian, he would drag them out, underscore that word. He would drag them out and put them in jail. Now, do you think that perhaps many of these folks were good folks? We're not talking here about folks who were murderers and rapists and that sort of thing. He's going to folks who are religious. He's going to good people, good moral people. People, no doubt, who in time past were recognized as good and faithful Jews. But now he's going to their houses and he's dragging them out and putting them in jail. And we know that when Stephen was stoned to death, Paul said to Timothy, I gave my vote against him. I held the garments of those who stoned him to death. Now, that we want to know. This is the history of this man. He compelled them to blaspheme, as we looked in Acts 26. He voted to kill them, casting his vote against them. He traveled to foreign cities to find those who were Christians, and we've noted that he got the letters from the courts in Jerusalem and traveled as far as Damascus, which who can tell me about how far away that was?
140 miles.
About 120 miles. Long way. 140 miles to go from Jerusalem to Damascus. Now, he didn't get on an airplane. He didn't get an automobile that would go down the highway doing 60, 70 miles an hour. That in itself tells us a great deal about his determination. And by the way, while you're considering travel in ancient times, when you familiarize yourself with the topography of where Paul was, Jerusalem is where? Up high on a mountain, about 3,000 feet elevation. In order to get to Damascus, you've got to cross something. What's that? Jordan River. The elevation of the Jordan River is about what? Well, as you come down to the Dead Sea, at the surface of the Dead Sea, what is it? That puts you almost near Jericho, Gilgal, thereabout. Below sea level. 1,300 feet below sea level. And as you go up on the other side to what we sometimes refer to as the Trans-Jordan side, of the land of Canaan. What's about the elevation over there? You're looking again about 3,000 feet elevation. Now, when you go from Jerusalem to Damascus, you've got to go from east to west to north to get there. You think that'd be a really easy trip, Richard, to travel 120, 140 miles over terrain like that? But he went that way in order that he might find folks who are Christians and bind them and bring them to prison. Now, this is the character that we're talking about. Saul of Tarsus. Now, on this road to Damascus, where we've noted that it was his desire to persecute those who are Christians. And let me underscore desire. He wanted to do this, thinking that this is what the Lord wanted him to do. But as we examine his efforts to go to Jerusalem, we've already looked at chapter 3 of Philippians. I want to call your attention to verse 6 as it continues there. He said, as touching zeal, persecuting the church, as touching the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. Zeal, persecuting the church. Why did Paul say to Timothy that he did that? Well, that's right, but why? Why did he do that? Alright, but was he? Now, when he wrote to Timothy, he specifies exactly why he did that. Not just that he thought he was doing right, but if you think you're doing right and you're doing wrong, where are you? You're ignorant. And, you know, we sometimes sling that word ignorant around like it's just a really bad, awful, ugly word. And it's just a state of being. It's not intended necessarily to be an awful, ugly word. It's a state of being. Now, either you know or you don't. That's what the word implies. You know something to be so, or you don't know. Doesn't mean you're dumb. Paul was not dumb. He was highly educated at the feet of Gamaliel. He just didn't know. Now, can you think of some of your family and friends that are not dumb? They're very intelligent people, but they just don't know. They're ignorant of things. But here's Saul of Tarsus. He just didn't know. Now, what didn't he know?
Well, it's also not believing. You can hear the truth and not believe it.
True. You're still ignorant.
Yeah, you're still ignorant. It's not what you don't know. It's not what you don't believe.
Yeah, true.
You've heard it.
True. No doubt Saul of Tarsus had heard this. I mean, he's been in Jerusalem for a long time. He just didn't believe it. But he said to Timothy, and I think this is worthy of noting, in 1 Timothy chapter 1, in verse 13, though I was before a blasphemer and a persecutor and injurious, howbeit I obtained mercy because I did it ignorantly in unbelief. Now there's the bringing together of those two thoughts. I did it ignorantly in unbelief. Now, why was Jesus crucified? Paul's put folks in prison doing it in ignorance. Why was Jesus crucified?
Because they were jealous.
Well, yes. I'm fishing again.
Ignorance.
Ignorance. And Acts chapter 3 and in verse 17, I know that in ignorance you did it, even as your rulers. You didn't know. You ever do something in ignorance? Let me ask you, I guess maybe another rhetorical question. You ever beat yourself up because you did something and later you realize just how ignorant you were? And you say, I can't believe I did that. I'm a smarter fellow than that. I can't believe I did that. Well, what's the problem? Would you have done it? Had you known? Lack of knowledge. Alright. So here's some things that Saul of Tarsus didn't know. And as a result, he's persecuting the church because he doesn't know. What is it he doesn't know? That he's persecuting Jesus. That's right. Now we have on the chart that he's violently arrogant. Well, and indeed, as he describes his condition prior, he didn't know. But from that, he persecuted folks who were Christians. I find it interesting in these two accounts, Acts 9 and Acts 8, he breathed threatening and slaughter against the church. Can you imagine such terms used to describe you? He made havoc. What's that word mean? He laid waste. He sought to destroy it. Now that's where he is. Laid waste, threatening and slaughter, tried to destroy it.
If you look at pictures of some of the German cities after World War II was over, you see how they were just laid waste. They're just desolate, or even Nagasaki or Hiroshima after those bombs were dropped. That's what Paul, or what Saul, rather, was doing to the church. That's what he envisioned doing to it, to lay it waste into nothing but rubble on the ground. And that's what he's determined to do.
That's right. Now let's take your comparison or analogy, and we look at the ruins and the cities after World War II and so forth, and we see cities destroyed. Now, no doubt, there were lives destroyed. Many of that, or much of that destruction was done in a massive way. You drop a bomb, hundreds are killed, you see. But that wasn't what Saul did. He entered into the houses, and he took them one by one, by one, by one, by one, and he arrested them and took them to be killed. Up close and personal is where we have Saul. Now, I said all that so that we get an image in our mind of who he is and why he's doing this.
Thinking of World War II, I picture more like the Gestapo, entering homes, dragging people out.
Oh, yeah.
And taking them away to be killed.
Yeah, that'd be a good analogy. This is what was done. And so here's Saul making his way to the city of Damascus, 140 or so miles. Across this land. Now, we talked about the travel routes and so forth in times gone by, and we talked about the significance of the city of Gilgal and the crossing that was generally recognized there and so forth. The travel route on the Transjordan side going up this way, making Damascus a major city. In fact, I'm told it's one of the, if not the, oldest Bible city that we know where it is. And so this is where he went, to Damascus, for the purpose of finding those who are Christians so that he might make havoc or destroy, lay waste the church. Now, in our study this morning, we're going to study a little bit about the vision that Paul saw on the road to Damascus. And we're not going to look necessarily at all of these accounts, but to bring together some things, let's look at Acts chapter 9, first of all, beginning in verse 3 through verse 5. Juan, would you mind to read for me, please? Acts chapter 9, 3 through 5.
Acts 9, 3 through 5. As he was traveling, it happened that he was approaching Damascus. Suddenly, light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he said, "Who are you, Lord?" And he said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But get up and enter the city, and it will be told you what you must do."
All right, several things we want to know in that. First of all, that when the Lord appeared to him, there was a bright light, and there was a voice. He saw something out of the ordinary, if I may put it that way, and he heard something that was extremely out of the ordinary. When you compare the accounts, we note that those who were with him, they saw the light, but they didn't hear the voice. And some folks say, well, you know, the Bible just contradicts itself.
So
no.
Says they heard the voice.
Heard the voice. It does here. Pardon me?
Didn't you just say they saw the light, but didn't hear?
In one of the other accounts, it says that. Yes, here it does. In Acts 22, if you'll note in verse 9, "And they that were with me beheld indeed the light, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me."
This is, they did not understand the voice.
That is correct.
They heard something, but didn't.
That is correct. Understanding is the key. They heard something, but they didn't understand. Saul did. He did. "Why persecutest thou me?" Well, who are you? "I'm Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest." Now, you know, sometimes we have to come to ourselves. You ever do that, Tommy? Ever come to yourself? We often talk about the young man prodigal of Luke chapter 15 and how that in the pig pen he came to himself. Well, what do you do when you come to yourself? Randy?
Come to your senses.
What does that mean? Before time you were crazy? Juan was. Yeah. Okay, he's nodding. Yes. All right.
You come to an understanding.
And in order to do that, sometimes you have to see yourself in a different light. Now, I suppose that one of the easiest and perhaps most common illustrations that I could think of would be the relationship between a husband and wife. And Juan, try not to quote me too much on this. But sometimes what is heard by the ears of the wife and vice versa was not what was intended by the person who said it. And so sometimes the person who heard it simply repeats what was said. And you say, well, that wasn't what I meant. Well, now you've heard it like they heard it. But that wasn't what you meant. And so sometimes we have to pedal backwards a little bit to get out of some of those messes that we get ourselves into. But what have we done when what we said has been repeated back? We've seen it in a different light. We saw it now, or see it now, as our companion saw it when we said it. Or you can push that thing over into actions. You know, sometimes you do something and you really don't realize the impact that that had because you never really thought about it like the other person thinks about it. Now, when you look at the prodigal, of Luke 15th chapter, when it tells us he came to himself. Don't you see him over here as a young, arrogant know-it-all coming to his father, I want my inheritance. And don't you see him living it up, as the text tells us, with riotous living. And now here's a famine in the country, and he has to reflect upon what he had at home. You think he sees himself in any different light to what he did before? Oh, yeah.
He was in the pit.
Yeah. Yeah, and what does he remember? Yeah. But he remembers more than that. He remembers that in my father's house, even the servants have bread enough and to spare. I just wish I had that. I'm going to go home and ask to be a servant. Now, what happened to that young, arrogant, foolish son over here? He just wants to be a slave now. He sees himself differently. And I want to suggest to you that on this occasion, when the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, it's time for reflection.
I find it fascinating that the same man whose idea of persuasion, you know, was intimidation, threats, murder, and so forth, I mean, that's how he saw it. I need to convert these people back to you, and that's all I'm going to accomplish. The same man who used those tactics told Timothy regarding Timothy's efforts then to teach others after he had come to himself, said in 2 Timothy 2:24 that the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind, able to teach, patient when wrong, with gentleness, correcting those who are in opposition, and perhaps God may grant them repentance, leading to the knowledge of the truth. Verse 26, that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, that Paul would have an understanding of what it means to come to your senses, and Paul's efforts to work with Timothy in terms of your efforts in teaching. It's not about threats, it's not about intimidation, it's about being able to teach, correcting those who are in opposition with gentleness, so they can come to their senses like I did.
Excellent. Excellent point. Yes, exactly right. And we've got to do that. But on the road to Damascus, when Saul asked the question, who art thou? What did the Lord say?
I am Jesus,
whom thou persecutest. Now, needless to say, that would change your perspective on some things. This is what you've been doing. And this is who I am. Now, the significance of that. We want to look at Acts chapter 26, and we're going to be talking about why the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus. You made an interesting observation, a fascinating observation there, Chris, about teaching and the examination of evidence. The evidence that's presented to Saul is a bit irrefutable, isn't it? How are you going to argue with that? I am Jesus whom thou persecutest. Well, you can't argue with that. And neither could Saul. For the Lord told him, it's hard for you to kick against the goad. Now, there's some evidence you just can't refute. Now, we think about that expression, and sometimes I find myself using expressions that don't mean anything because they don't communicate anything. Nobody knows what that means. And it may be true with a whole lot of what I say, but I hope that with this illustration, we've all got it. What was a goad? A cattle prod? All right, that's right. Yeah, it's what was used to move the oxen, and it was a stick, basically, to gouge them and make them go. And when the Lord said, it's hard for you to kick against the goad. I remember when we were on the farm, sometimes we didn't do this, but when you take cattle to the auction to be sold, if you've ever experienced that, sometimes the folks that are putting the cow or calves or whatever in the ring where they're being auctioned, they'll use what we call a hot stick. And it's just a stick that's charged, and it'll give them an electrical boot if they don't go where they're supposed to go. And you tag them with that stick, and it's like the ox go. It'll make them go. And when the Lord said, it's hard for you to kick against the goat, it is. You're going to go where the evidence leads you if you're honest. Now, when the evidence was presented to Saul of Tarsus, what did he have to do with it? Man, I got to stop, reexamine this thing, because the Lord just told me who He is, what this is all about. I'm Jesus, whom thou persecutest.
He knew who Jesus was. He just didn't believe Jesus was the Christ.
That's right.
And evidence that He was the Christ had been presented to him before this moment.
Yes.
And he'd been fighting against it.
That's right.
I mean, all the evidence of all the miracles and everything that happened, he was fighting against that evidence up until this point.
That's right. What was different about this one? He saw the resurrected Christ. I tell you, it's one thing for somebody to say, well, you know, I saw the resurrected Christ. But now here, he saw Him personally, up close, personally.
Kind of feeding off that idea, but I think it's interesting to know how often God reveals Himself as light to men, and Jesus in particular here, shining a bright light upon Saul, as we've been talking about the enlightenment that he gained from this experience. And that's how John the Apostle begins the beginning of the Gospel of John, chapter 1. In him was life, and the life was the life of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. That's where Saul was to start all of this. He saw all of those things that Jesus had done and the things that were going on by Peter and the other apostles in Jerusalem. But he didn't see the light. The darkness did not comprehend it. And then later on, he talks about there was the true light which coming into the world enlightens every man. And he was in the world and the world was made for him and the world did not know him. Again, speaking about Jesus and the darkness that people still continue to live in, even though he was giving them this enlightenment as to who he was and God's intentions for them. And now here you have Saul lying in this bright light as Jesus is revealing himself to him and saying, this light's been here this whole time. Don't live in darkness. And it's just interesting, the aspect of how God reveals himself in light.
Yeah.
So often with the intention of opening people's eyes in a very literal sense.
Interesting that you would say that, because the next point that I wanted to establish is that the reason the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus was to provide for him evidence that he might turn folks from darkness to light. In the text of Acts 26, beginning in verse 16, it says, "But arise and stand upon thy feet, for to this end have I appeared unto thee, to appoint thee a minister and a witness both of the things wherein thou hast seen me, and of the things wherein I will appear unto thee, delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles unto whom I send thee, to open their eyes, that they may turn from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive remission of sins and an inheritance among them that are sanctified by faith in thee. What a powerful passage. The Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus. So, number one, he'd be qualified to be an apostle. We know that from Acts chapter 1, having seen the resurrected Christ. Number two, he could be a witness of that fact. And in his preaching, his teaching, he could turn men from darkness to light. And that's referred to in this text as forgiveness of sins. Powerful, powerful illustration.
Also, the bright light, as he says in 26, I lost what verse it is, where it says it's brighter than the sun. Verse 13, 26:13. Saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun shining all around me. So I had this bright light followed by 3 days of blindness. And it wasn't the light that blinded me. I mean, speculating that because I didn't say anybody else was stricken blind. But he was stricken blind for a reason.
Yeah.
And he had 3 days to think about it. What he'd been told, what he'd been told to do.
Yeah. Kind of a neat text, isn't it? Alright. Interestingly enough, Juan, in verse 6, when you were reading that from the 9th chapter, the Lord told Saul, go into the city, and there will be told thee what thou must do. What you must do. Now, an interesting thought just there. I've heard folks argue and say, well, that when he went into Damascus, he was told where he was to go and his work and that sort of thing. No, no. Saul had asked, Lord, what wilt thou have me do? And the Lord told him to go into the city, and there will be told thee what thou must do. Now, we're not just talking about his travel and the message he would preach and so forth and so on. When Ananias came to him in Acts 22, verse 16, what did he ask him? Now, you know this verse, Acts 22, 16. What's it say?
Why do you delay?
Why do you delay? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins. Now, that's just incredibly noteworthy. Acts 22, verse 16. Now, if you don't know that passage, what it says and where it's found, you must learn that because you will be asked that again. That will be on the test, as I sometimes say. Acts 22, verse 16. Now, arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins. James, what was Saul's condition before Ananias came to him?
He's lost spiritually.
Lost. How we know that? Alright, so he's still in the guilt, bondage of his sin. How do we know that?
Well, you wouldn't tell him to wash away his sins if they were already gone.
Isn't that a novel thought? That's true. And is there any other evidence to that effect? Again, I'm fishing.
His emotional state, as it were, being
Yeah. He was in Damascus how long?
3 days.
And what was his condition? Blind, never didn't eat or drink for 3 days. How does that compare with every example of conversion in the book of Acts?
Rejoicing versus being miserable.
Yeah. Now, if he was saved on the road to Damascus, you think he'd be miserable? Well, no. But he's miserable, which indicates that he's not yet saved. Now, you need to know that because there are folks who are going to tell you that the Lord was generous to Saul, saved him on the road to Damascus. No, sir. The Lord presented evidence to Saul who he is, that he's the Christ, the Son of God. Now, Saul is meant. How would you feel about your life, Lynn, if you realized that for the most of your adult life, you've been tormenting the very thing that you need to be building up. Yeah. You think that's the state of mind he's in? He didn't either eat nor drink for 3 days. When Ananias came to him and restored his sight, said, arise and be baptized, how did he respond to that? Mr. John, How did Saul respond to the instructions of Ananias to arise and be baptized? Well, I'll do that next week. I know I need to do that, but what did he do?
Immediately.
Now, we know that from the account when we compare them. From the 9th chapter, verse 18, he arose and was baptized. And you can underscore that. The wording is not accidental. Arise and be baptized. He arose and was baptized. And you notice that he did not delay. He did not have good intentions. Somebody said the way to hell is paved with good intentions, and that's right. He arose and was baptized. You see the urgency of this circumstance. And so he was told to go to the city of Damascus, and there will be told thee what thou must do. Now, when he got to Damascus, let's see. David Skinner, would you read some for me, please? Acts chapter 9, verses 10 through 19. All right, now here's my question. How would you like to be Ananias? How about you, Randy? You want to be Ananias?
It'd be kind of tough, but I'd be glad that he was blind.
Well put. Okay. Well, what I want you to see is that Ananias has a pretty good task. To go to this man that he's heard so much about, and obviously for a considerable amount of time, and to know the horrible things that Saul of Tarsus had done. And he's come to Damascus to find those who are Christians, to bind them, to take them to Jerusalem, no doubt that they might be slaughtered. And here you are, a Christian, in Damascus, and the Lord telling you, I want you to go preach to this man. What?
Kind of a side note, sorry, but a side thought. Why the difference in, what's your thoughts behind, why the difference in the telling of the stories? Why is it that in this part, we're sitting here saying, Jesus just appeared to him and said, go to Damascus, but then later in 22, he says, this entire paragraph is what he was told. And what Ananias said, why the difference in those two telling of the stories?
Because in one account, we have Luke. Luke records all of it, of course. He's the historical writer. And in Acts chapter 9, we have Luke writing us the history, or writing the history, recording it for us of what happened. When we come to Acts 22, Luke is the writer, he's the recorder, but whose words is he recording? Paul's. Paul's saying, here's what was done. He gives it play by play. Now, when he comes to, or we come to Acts 26 and read that account, yes, we've got Luke the recorder, he's the writer. But who's the speaker? Paul is, before King Agrippa. So that accounts for details here that are given by Paul that are not necessarily recorded in the historical account of Acts chapter 9.
Different audiences.
Different audiences too, yes. Different audiences. Yeah. Very good. Very good question. Okay? So here's Ananias. What are you going to do about this, Bruce? I want you to go preach to this man. And I've heard a lot of bad things about him. Well, I want you to go preach to him anyway.
I'm going
to have a gun. Yeah. Well, now, what I want you to see is the similar reaction of all of you. You know, the hair on the back of your neck kind of stands up when you think about who this man is. And not only are you afraid that he's going to find out that I'm a Christian, but now you're going to go to him and identify yourself. What might happen to me? And I tell you what, folks, myself included, we often find ourselves in that similar circumstance. We think of friends and family members and so forth, and what's going to happen if they find out I believe this, or if they find out I teach this, or if I go to them and try to teach them this, then what's the result or consequence going to be? You think that ever went through Ananias' mind? Well, yeah, he tells us it did. Yeah. Now here's the Lord telling Ananias, this is what I want you to do. And how are you going to react to that? We've identified the challenge. But now here's the key. We say that this is a test to his faith. Who told Ananias that? Lord did. The Lord told Ananias, I'm going to show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. He's going to stand before the nation of the Jews. He's going to stand before kings and governors. That's what he's going to do. Now, Ananias, here's the question. Do you believe me? Now that's the question, isn't it? That's what Saul's going to do. Do you believe what I'm telling you? Now if you believe what I'm saying to you, what will you do? You're going to go talk to Saul. Tell him what he must do. Bruce?
You know, the other thing is the Lord has told Ananias about what he did.
Well,
and now when he speaks to Saul, that's how he lets him know. Well, you know, the Lord told me, and that's how Saul also identifies that he's the Lord who has control of all this, and he's the one that he's seen Ananias.
Yeah, he's seen a vision that a man named Ananias is going to come to him. Yeah, that'd be you. So, Mr. Ananias, do you believe what I'm telling you? Now, I think that's key to this whole context. Do you believe what I said? Now, when we say, well, his faith was tested, isn't ours? You see, it's not a matter of I can quote this verse or I know where this is found and I go to worship every time the doors are open. That's not the point. The point is, do you believe what God said? Now, we've hammered this and hammered this and hammered this so many times before in other classes, when we talked about Abraham and how that Abraham was told to go and offer Isaac as a sacrifice unto the Lord. And we get all balled up in the emotional argument. I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could kill myself. That's not the point. The point is, God had told Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. God had told Abraham, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now, Abraham, do you believe that? When I go take your son and kill him. How did Abraham reason? Well, God will raise him from the dead if need be. He'll do what he said. All right. Lots to be talked about.